Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session for two minutes.
Morning, be seated, please. First case in our calendar is 99-12, State of Ohio. Dania Child, Ms. Ashbury.
May it please the court, I'm going to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time, you have a clock.
I'm here today on behalf of the State of Ohio to ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case for the three propositions of law argued in my brief. The defendant in this case was a Dayton officer, a Dayton police officer. She was indicted and convicted for participation in a series of aggravated drug trafficking conspiracies where a Dayton street cop would shake down drug dealers on the street, take their drugs, and then arrange for the retail back out on the street. Defendant's role varied from these drug transactions, from brokering deals to taking money to dispensing the drugs to the street level dealer.
And this happened on a number of occasions, didn't it?
This happened on a number of occasions.
Why shouldn't they all be merged into one charge, like the Court of Appeals said?
Because the conspiracy statute, Your Honor, is looking to punish those who commit acts and then enter into a agreement to commit a crime and then commit the overt act to commit the crime. And when that's done, when we have agreement and an act and that object of that conspiracy is completed, that is a separate conspiracy, and that's the case was here.
But isn't it a continuing course of conduct?
The tapes used in this case show that these were actually individual transactions. These were separate conversations, separate negotiations, separate sales, and the conversations went towards one specific sale. These weren't towards a big, overarching, we're going to do everything we can to sell as many drugs as we can. We're going to sell 20 ounces to this guy now.
Supposing there's a half a dozen people in a grocery store and somebody goes in with a gun, robs the first one, walks across to the next aisle and robs the second one, and so on. Separate crimes?
Yeah, I think in that case, yes. But that would be
so you charge him with six counts of robbery, armed robbery.
If you can show a separate analysis in those cases, I think that there's a decision to enter a store and that there's robbery, and there's a separate decision to go and rob each individual person in that store.
I guess my concern is, are we doing this just because it's the RICO statute, or should the RICO statute follow the general law with regard to a continuing course of conduct?
The state's concern in this case, the Court of Appeals made it very difficult for the state to conspiracy charges in general. Not just, certainly one of the problems here was the merge of the RICO charge, so it made it impossible for us to ever get a RICO conviction. But even broader than that, the Court of Appeals decision is going to make it very difficult for the state to punish a conspiracy. And what it's actually done is provide a shield for defendants. As long as they're acting in the same group of conspirators, committing the same general types of crimes, it's sort of a blanket rule put down by the court. Even when there's no evidence of a continuing conspiracy agreement.
You say the Court of Appeals made it very difficult for you to get a RICO conviction, or impossible to get a RICO conviction. They said you've got a RICO conviction. They just want you to have one instead of a series, don't they?
Well, I think what the Court of Appeals did as far as the RICO did was are padding the drug activity with a series with these separate conspiracies mm-hmm. with the state was charging. And when the court looked at the difference in the simple merger, that the court would say, yes, both of these crimes exist, but we're going to merge it for the purpose of sentencing. The court said, no, this is only one conspiracy. And if this is only one conspiracy, the state of Moss is having the pattern of offenses based on the
Jimmy, before you go, I have the same question that Cliff brought up. I think it's a pretty important issue, at least for me. The statute says continuous conspiratorial relationship. You said contract. Doesn't have to be any contract here.
I'm sorry, I have to stop.
Okay, express relationship. Why was there not a conspiratorial continuous relationship here? There was, wasn't there?
Perhaps put it in an example of where I think a continuous conspiratorial relationship is. There's an agreement, say, rob a bank, and it's part of that big agreement to do this one crime, to rob the bank, there's separate agreements that need to be made to buy the gun, to steal the car, to put somebody out of the watch. All of those, they're separate agreements, but then the continuous relationship. Continuing spiritual relationship.
That lead to the criminal act, the ultimate criminal act.
The ultimate criminal act, which is the robbery of one bank. Now, what the state is arguing is that's true, continuous spiritual relationship. But when those bank robbers get done with that bank robbery, go back and say, hey, that was pretty easy, let's do it again. This is a new conspiracy, a new conspiracy is informed, and this is not a continuing spiritual relationship.
What if give all the facts you just gave, but they say we're going to rob three banks?
I think if the original object of the agreement is we're going to commit this series of crimes, then yes. So that would be something that's prior to the acts towards that object of three bank robberies would be a continuing spiritual relationship. But here, there's no evidence of such an agreement. These were individual drug transactions that were separately negotiated, and the tapes, state was the benefit of having the tapes to show the negotiations towards the individual sale, and they all go towards one specific sale. In that final tape where Sean Paul is in the room and Nia Child is talking to her husband, you can see that the money is collected, and then they start new negotiations. Well, we're going to enter it. Well, I don't know. Does he have the money to pay for it? That's when a new spiritual relationship is formed, towards a new object, and that is the sale of that next specified amount of drugs.
So you don't put much weight on the fact that these are the same persons that are engaged in similar conduct. Your argument is there has to be a separate agreement. There has to be an agreement to perform all of the illegal acts, rather than the fact that these people are together and they've got a relationship, and from that comes sort of a series of illegal acts.
I think what the primary focus should be is on the object of the original agreement, and although it's going to be certainly important who are the parties and who are what type of actions, but I think the focus is going to be on what is the object of the original agreement. And this brings to another question.
And when you say object of the original agreement, do you differentiate between an agreement that says from now on the three of us will be, you know, the new kingpins in the drug world here in Dayton, or let's get this guy and then rob this guy? I mean, what if you just said we're going to now have this gang, we're going to do this?
And I think that then the object is to do whatever it takes to sell as many drugs as you can take, as many have, exactly what the Court of Appeals found here was an overarching conspiracy to do as many crimes and to sell as many drugs as we can. And that would be an overarching conspiracy. Another concern of the state in this case is we're just looking at the parties and just looking at the basic kind of activity they're involved in. If we prosecute a defendant, the big conspiracy is still going on, and our defendant gets back out and gets back into the same group of people committing the same group of crimes, they're going to run into another death involved. We've already prosecuted this guy for his participation in that conspiracy. We're never going to be able to prosecute him again because of double jeopardy. And that's another concern that the Court of Appeals decision is raised in this case. The Court of Appeals decision made it further difficult for the state to prosecute conspiracies by lumping these all together in one overarching conspiracy, and then required that the state list in the indictment the elements of each underlying crime. Now, that can be whether there's separate underlying crimes, separate degrees, separate elements. There's no guidance for the state at this point. It says, well, what do we need to put in the indictment? This is an overarching conspiracy. Secondly, if this had been a conspiracy to traffic controlled substance, given one substance like cocaine and maybe a Schedule 3 substance, we're going to have aggravated trafficking, we're going to have trafficking. How many of those elements is the state going to be required to put in if we're prosecuting this big idea of the overall conspiracy? Criminal Rule 7 requires that the state inform the defendant of the elements of the offense being charged when the state set out an offense. And I think it also goes that the defendant knows what charge he's defending against, but he knows the level of crime. In this case, he was charged with conspiracy. The elements of conspiracy, looking at count 14 of the indictment specifically, which is what the Court of Appeals addressed, the elements of the conspiracy are set out. And it's clear from looking at aggravated trafficking under this subsection that the underlying crime was a felony offense. It had just been trafficking and there's been some confusion we might have issues. But this is aggravated trafficking. We know that the underlying crime was a felony offense. And the state would contend that this is sufficient under Criminal Rule 7 to inform the defendant where of what crime he was committing. And the indictments for conspiracy that do not have the underlying elements listed are not favorably sufficient.
Is your case bottomed on count 14?
I'm sorry?
Is your case bottomed or does it rest on count 14?
Well, in part it does. It's a separate conviction.
But you also are talking about 4, 5, and 6. And what about the fact that the alleged co-conspirators, being the necessary predicate for the RICO statute, were found not guilty?
I don't think that there's any bearing in this case. That it was tried before a jury, and that jury found her guilty of the conspiracy.
So you can conspire with somebody who hasn't conspired?
I think if our defendants entered into an agreement to participate in the criminal act, and an overt act has been done, she is not the elements of the conspiracy. The state doesn't even need to prove an action. The state doesn't even need to prove the ultimate crime has been committed. But we need to prove the elements, and those were the elements that were proven in this case.
I suppose it trivializes it. I don't mean to do that, but it takes two to tango. Can you tango with yourself? Here,
yeah.
These other people were found not to have engaged in a conspiracy.
And I think this court has held, as Mike said, they were submarried, that, yeah, it doesn't take you to tango. One person can be sufficient to, as long as she made the agreement and the elements are met towards her. Briefly, I'd also like to address this burden of proof issue that was raised in the state's first time in America, because I think that's the point of appeal for most egregious error. This is a statutory motion to suppress, with absolutely no alleged state action, and there's no 14th Amendment right, and the Court of Appeals, really without justification, shifts the burden of proof to the state. There's simply no justification in this case to differ from the traditional rule that the moving party has the burden of proof. And Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Unless you have further questions at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Ashford. Mr. Smiley.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Charles Smiley, on behalf of the Chavez, the appellee in this matter. Your Honors, your justices have asked why merger applies in this case, and I think in its principal approach, you must realize that a conspiracy is an inchoate crime. It takes place literally under federal law, in fact, just in the minds of participants. They don't require overt acts in some of their conspiracies, drug conspiracies particularly, where other general conspiracies and overt act like Ohio law is required. Now, Ohio law is very distinct on the matter. We have indeed a statute. And that statute says, recognition of the inchoate nature of the crime, that multiple offenses committed toward one singular conspiratorial objective remain just a single conspiracy. And the focus for that is very simply put, to avoid what constitutionally is mandated to avoid, multiple penalties for the same conduct.
On that argument, then, the prosecutor has claimed that we have held the court of appeals version, if your client judicially were convicted of conspiracy, and then went back out, which is in the same act of the same group, double definitely, how would you respond to that if you're arguing?
I disagree completely with my colleague. The state in Ohio has to render its charges by way of an indictment. It is quite common, quite practical, and normal for the state to bring an indictment for a conspiracy alleging a period of time. Conspiracy began or operated from this point in time A until this point in time B. And during this time, certain overt acts were committed. This is indeed how the charges are brought now. If one is brought at that point in time and then new acts and new conspiratorial relationships exist, it's simply a matter of a second indictment. There is no double jeopardy. It's not the same conduct. So, in my view, the merger applies because the simple mandate of the Ohio statute requires it. Here you have the sequence of events all taking place admittedly within a 40-day period of time. 40 days. By a series of telephone calls, you have the same people. You have the same overt acts by language in each of the indicted counts, alleging conspiracy. That is, in my view, no clearer circumstance where you want to avoid the multiple punishment for the same conduct. It's very clear here. The cases support that. The Court of Appeals relied on State versus Powell. That was an appellate court decision. Unreported is cited here. They know that. They know Brodmann, United States v. Brodmann, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, taking the same position, all with the same focus. And here, that just simply is not the case. There is a single event. There is a single relationship. There is a single ongoing agreement, whether implied or otherwise. There is indeed a single focus, a single object. The state in its trial case here has indicated that the RICO was a combination robbery and drug trafficking, taking drugs off the street and reselling. That was the focus, that was the object, and as has been heard here, no matter how many crimes you need to do to accomplish that, if it's within that same objective, it's a single conspiracy. That's what the state of the Court of Appeals held here. There's nothing novel about it. It is nothing more than an application of facts that are to existing mandated, legislated mandate.
Would there ever be separate convictions in a RICO conspiracy case?
Yes, there can be.
Your learned colleague says no, and it seems to me if there's clearly separate animus, that it's separate crimes, aren't they?
Absolutely. Mr. Justice, if you and I agreed to rob a bank...
Yeah, let's use somebody else.
If we wanted to rob a bank today, and we did so, we could be charged and convicted. And if next year we decided to do the same thing again, we can be charged and convicted, and we can be convicted as a conspiracy, even if they cannot prove the substantive act itself, if they have the necessary proof. There is nothing in the Nevada law which prohibits multiple punishment for multiple crimes. The problem here is our legislator has said multiple conspiracies for the same object under the same relationship is only one crime.
One conspiracy.
Right.
What about separate drug sales?
Separate drug sales, if the object is a conspiracy for drug trafficking, are consistent with that objective.
One conspiracy. Where's your selling heroin one day and cocaine the next day?
If the conspirators want to limit their activities, if you will, and deal only in heroin, and suddenly someone deals in cocaine, that could be, at least as to that person and those who concur, a separate conspiracy.
Okay.
But if the object is drug trafficking, cocaine, heroin, LSD, any other drug of illegal nature, then that's within the scope of what the group has decided to do. And each one, as the court is well aware, is equally guilty. If you have the agreement and an overt act, that's it.
So if you walked into the grocery store, like I was asking your learned colleague, going to rob everybody in the store, you do it separate aisles, separate times, separate places, all one conspiracy.
That is correct, Judge. If it's a conspiracy, then you charge it. Now, the difference here, you see, you're making a distinction between the inchoate crime and the commission of the underlying substantive offense.
Yep.
You can have six different robberies in that store because you have six different victims. But those are completion of the committed underlying offense. When you have the inchoate crime, the conspiracy, that's the danger, and that's why the limitation is one conspiracy.
So you'd have one shot, you'd have one conspiracy charge and six armed robberies.
If that's part of the objective of the conspiracy, it is one conspiracy crime. And of course, you see in our laws, as you know, conspiracy itself is required to merge when the commission of the offenses occurs. You can't hit both. You can't charge with a conspiracy and a completed crime. See, that's statutory. If I may, looking at the sufficiency here, the state's argued that they don't know what to indict here. State versus Headley, passed by that, enacted by this court some time ago, remains operative law. When you're dealing with trafficking, you must level, you must indicate the nature of the drug. Why? Because under our legislative system of penalties for drug trafficking, the penalty, the degree of the charge, relates to the nature of the substance as well as the weight or the quantity thereof. And so it becomes extremely important if you're going to, under Rule 7, inform the defendant of the nature of the charges, that you give him exactly that item, the contraband and the quantity of it. Without that, you don't have that. And indeed, as Edley says, a bill of particulars is not a sufficient way to do it. You must indict. There's no mystery here. You simply indict. Here, you have a conspiracy. The crime is an agreement plus an overt act. And indeed, in this case, the overt acts were the same. The exact same. If you look at the indictment, the exact same for each of the conspiracies. Telephone conversations. Same participants. So what you have here is what is known is the nature of the charge. What was lacking in that one count is the specific nature of the drug that was alleged to have been the subject of that conspiracy. The relevance of the underlying substantive charge, whether it's a robbery or trafficking by way of amassing quantity or trafficking by way of preparing for shipment or trafficking by way of offering and sell, those differences only tell you the degree of the charge, the specific charge that the conspiracy relates to. Because in the drug trafficking area, you are a notch below what that charge is. And that's the relevance of it. But in terms of the crime, the indictment states for a conspiracy need only assert the overt act and the conspiratorial relationship.
So, I'm sorry, I need to go back to the other issue. May I, please?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
If you only have one conspiracy, or if you have a proven conspiracy, then you cannot penalize the individual predicate crime which supports that conspiracy. Is that right? I didn't think that was right. I thought you said that, and I'm struggling with that.
Yes, Your Honor. A conspiracy as a charge is inchoate, and under our law, you can't convict on a conspiracy charge to aggravated trafficking, and at the same time convict on that same trafficking. You can't have the both of them. Now, what Your Honor, your Justice may be looking at is the the RICO statute, which permits a conviction on engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, that statute requires that there be at least two precursive criminal felony conduct activities as the necessary predicate for that particular...
And can you punish separately for them? Can you punish separately for those?
Yes, you can. State v. Bourbon.
Yeah, so I thought I understood you to say you cannot.
Not on the RICO, no.
I mean, for instance, the armed robbery that I gave you in the grocery store.
Yes.
Seemed to me you ended up by saying all you can do if they went had a conspiracy to do this is convict for the conspiracy, not for the separate six robberies.
No, you can prove the substantive act.
Okay.
That's the issue.
That's
if you can prove that there was a robbery, then you can convict me on the robbery. But you can't convict me on a conspiracy leading up to the robbery and then on the robbery.
Counsel, likewise on RICO, you can convict on if you have a series of independent drug transactions, you can put those together.
Convict me on all of them.
You can convict on each one of those, and you can also bring successfully the RICO charge.
That is correct. That is correct on the RICO. They are separate acts. One just happens to be a precursor or predicate for the other. But they are separately.
But the problem with RICO here is they're trying to put together two conspiracies,
correct,
to get to the RICO.
That is correct. And that's really all the Court of Appeals says, you know, as I think this is the Chief Justice said, you have a conspiracy here, but you don't have a RICO because you only have one predicate act. If you take the three acts that are relied upon by the state and its charging instrument, the indictment, as the premise for the RICO, you still only have one conspiracy that was charged.
The bridge got charged for 14 transactions to get the conspiracy charge.
If they could prove it,
right.
Absolutely.
They couldn't prove it.
That's why in my indication in the mayor's brief, you must understand everything starts with the premise of how the charging is done. We didn't select that. My colleagues did. And they obviously, according to ethics and professional considerations, charge according to what they don't in good faith, they could prove beyond reasonable doubt. And that remains only the conspiracies. I trust them to their judgment. But you're correct, if they could have indicted and proven the substantive act, it would have been completely different. Lastly, in terms of the burden of proof on suppression, I disagree again with my colleague that the law in Ohio has been clear for a long time. When you have a warrantless intrusion, the burden has always been upon the proponent of the evidence.
But that's where there's state action, where the
that is correct.
Police go to the house or whatever. And here, this is different, isn't it? How does the state get the evidence introduced without, under the Court of Appeals statement of law, without one of the conspirators, so-called co-conspirators, turning state's evidence, if you will? How do they get...
By that, Mr. Justice, Chief Justice, I presume you mean turning state's evidence and indicating that there was a consent or satisfying the other criteria of our statute. You probably cannot, because I think under state versus Didnos, the focus on this is a policing matter, not an explanatory one. This court's decision in Didnos says that our wiretap statutes are clearly explicit. There are no exceptions to it. And you either satisfy the legislative exceptions for use or you cannot. It is as much focused on preventing use and disclosure as it is on how to acquire the material. The good faith nature of acquiring the material is not the relevant issue of focus here. The harm comes in the violation of the right of one's expectation to privacy. And once, of course, it's disclosed, as you said, the cat's out of the bag, you can't take it back. The harm has been done. Interestingly, in this case, if that occurred here, there is no remedy to the harm to aggrieved party as the statute would otherwise allow. Who does one sue? How does one handle it? And in this case, how does my client handle, if she bears the burden, compelling a co-defendant to come in and say, I gave no consent? We can't compel a co-defendant to take a stand on our behalf in any matter, let alone suppression here. So we're remedialists, if you will, in taking the position that the defendant bears the burden in this case. It is the state that sought to use the evidence, and they need only put on sufficient evidence to show that they have the right to use it in consistently with our wiretap statute. The opportunity, by the way, was afforded them in two hearings in this trial court matter, and in both they declined to inquire. No cross-examination.
Thank you, Mr. Smiley.
Thank you.
Ms. Ashbury, you've saved almost 10 minutes of your time.
The problem with the Court of Appeals' decision in this case is they lumped these conspiracies together without any evidence of one big overarching conspiracy. That's the problem. Had there been evidence that, yes, we're going to do everything we can do to sell as many drugs as we can, that would be wonderful. But here, the court lumped them together. Even when there was evidence of separate individual negotiations for each transaction, they lumped them together, creating basically a blanket rule that if you've got the same basic group of conspirators participating in the same basic crime, the state, you only got one overlying conspiracy, even when there's no evidence to support that.
The whole thing you'd like to do here is get multiple convictions so you get multiple sentences. Right? The reason I ask is why wouldn't you just charge him with all the underlying drug cases?
And in this case, the state felt for Denise Thomas, we didn't have the evidence. We never caught him.
That's the problem.
We never caught him with drugs. But the legislature has given us the power to charge conspiracy when we can meet the elements. And I don't think it's any less of a crime because we can't charge her with the drugs in hand. It's a crime set up by the legislature, a specific penalty set up by the legislature. This focuses on the dangers of this incoherent set of crime and the dangers of all these people being involved, which is a whole lot harder to stop because if one person is being involved and that person has got the drug in
hand. But you want to, you're also disappointed you can't jump on up to RICO. But RICO is a very special statute with draconian remedies. And therefore, should it not be limited to cases in which you've got the defendant cold turkey in terms of the underlying offenses?
Can I have a moment to answer?
Sure.
What the state is concerned about is when we all are jumped into one overlying conspiracy, the state is not only handicapped in prosecuting RICO, but handicapped in prosecuting individuals who are participating in a serious conspiracy. It does come down. We do have a problem prosecuting it with RICO, and that is a problem. Because if they're all one overarching conspiracy, there simply is no pattern. But it's broader than that. A problem is going to be with charging conspiracies in general. As long as people are involved with the same group of conspiracies and same crime, the Court of Appeals and Society can shield. For these reasons, the reasons argued in my brief, I'd ask the court to demand to reverse the Court of Appeals' decision and reinstate the trial court's decision on the
case. Thank you, Ms. Ashbury. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.